And welcome back. I'm Michaela, and this is Lactation Station. I just want to say hi to everybody. And I want to remind you, if you have friends that are looking into lactation or they're interested in lactation, have them check out the podcast. You know, it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy talking to you guys. And today I want to talk about breast surgeries. Through the course of the last few months, I've met several people that have asked me if they can lactate after having implants. And usually when I ask where the implants are or what kind of incision was performed, on several occasions, these people have no idea exactly what was done, which I find strange and odd. You know, you should be talking to your plastic surgeon. Today, we are going to talk about the different surgeries, the different ways the surgeries are performed, and how they can affect lactation and your lactation journey. The ability to lactate after a breast reduction depends on whether the surgeon leaves nerve pathways and blood supply intact, and whether the tissue is removed without regard for these structures. The adipose or fatty tissue of the breast is inseparably connected to the glandular tissue. Therefore, breast reduction cannot be done simply by removing the adipose tissue because it's all like one mass. It's all, you know, connected together. Women with the least amount of glandular tissue removed, they have the greater opportunity to lactate, particularly if the fourth intercostal nerve, and I'll explain what that is later, is left intact. So there are two types of techniques used for breast reduction, the pedicle and the free nipple. The pedicle technique is the most common used in women of childbearing age. The nipple and the areola remain attached to the breast on a pedicle, hence the name. And now, what is a pedicle? A pedicle, by definition, is part of the skin or tissue that is temporarily left attached to the gland. In plastic surgery, the surgeon leaves part of the skin and tissue with the nerves and vessels that supply the breast intact. A wedge of tissue is then removed from the sides of the underside of the breast. Because the breast ducts, blood supply, and some nerves remain intact, lactation is possible after this surgery, but successful lactation cannot be predicted with certainty. Now, in the free nipple technique, and I gotta tell you, when I was reading about this one, it really made me cringe, because what they do is they remove the nipple and the areola completely from the breast, and they put it in a saline solution, kind of like a skin graft. It's kept in the solution while additional tissue is removed. The nipple and areola are then stitched back into place. This technique is usually used for larger-breasted women. It's designed to reduce risk and complications and to reposition the nipple on resculpted breasts. Lactation and suckling is possible with the pedicle technique, but it's much less likely with the free nipple technique because the blood supply of the nipple and areola are completely severed and damage to the nerves occur. The fourth intercostal nerve. It's really important that this nerve remains intact. The fourth intercostal nerve, which is found on each breast, is critical to milk expression. The nerves tell the brain to release the hormone prolactin and oxytocin, which triggers milk to flow. If this nerve is damaged, milk expression does not happen as easily. It's really important that that nerve on each side is not messed with. Breast reduction is not uncommon. And I was really surprised when I read that 500,000 women have reductions each year. That is a lot. That number just blew me away that so many people are having breast reductions. But there's also a lot of misinformation about the challenges facing lactation women after surgery. There's also very few studies on how breast surgery affects lactation. How lactation is affected after breast surgery depends on a couple of things. The type of surgery involved, whether important nerves and milk ducts have been cut, whether the nipple has been repositioned, and whether the blood supply to the breast is intact. How much glandular tissue remains? Glandular tissue is interspersed with fatty tissue. We talked about that just a minute ago. Breast reduction can affect milk-making capacity depending on how much functional glandular tissue is left after the surgery. The more tissue that is removed by the surgery, the more likely lactation will be an issue. And there's also how much time has passed. Most citation consultants will tell you the longer it's been since you've had a breast reduction, the better your chances are. Because as time passes after a breast reduction, damaged nerves may reconnect and severed ducts may make new connections to the nipple. And the nipple that may have lost some sensitivity may develop more sensitivity again, and the ability to produce milk can improve. Some milk ducts that have been cut or damaged may reconnect or develop new pathways to carry milk to the nipple. Hormones, and to a small extent, your menstruation cycle, can help with the development of new glandular tissue. Lactation also helps, but recovery will be limited by how much breast tissue and milk ducts remain. If you're lactating for the first time after a breast reduction surgery, you may experience engorgement. And engorgement is a good sign that functional milk-making tissue is still present. However, some of the milk ducts may be blocked due to your surgery or scar tissue. One breast may be more engorged than the other. Areas of the breast that are not able to be emptied will shut down milk production. If you do not have sensitivity in your nipples, it can be hard to have a letdown. But there are other ways to condition this response with other triggers. And this goes back to a previous episode that I did when I talked about the Russian neurophysiologist Ivan Pavlov and his experiment with conditioned reflex, his famous Pavlov's dog experiment. And I'll just briefly go over it basically for those of you that aren't familiar with the experiment, or even worse yet, you haven't listened to my episode on Pavlov's dog experiment. On numerous occasions, a bell is rung and then the dog is fed. The dog salivates in anticipation of being fed. Eventually, the bell is rung with no food and the dog still salivates. The takeaway is the dog learns to respond to the sound of the bell and not the food. So how do we use this in lactation? First, you create a letdown cue, or something, you know, you do each and every time without fail before pumping or a suckling session. Eventually, you'll create a conditioned reflex to your letdown cue. Pump or suckling is an unconditioned stimulus. Letdown is the response to pumping, which is an unconditional reflex. Your letdown cue is the conditioned stimulus. And then letdown to the stimulus of your cue alone is the conditioned reflex. So your letdown cue should be used directly before and just as you begin your session. And intensity makes a huge difference. Using a couple of different cues at the beginning should work better than just starting your session. You know, maybe your it's a cup. You use the same cup. Maybe you drink hot tea, you know, so you have the same hot tea before you pump. Whatever it is that works for you. Maybe you watch a Netflix show. Maybe you just turn on Netflix. You know, when I did my episode on the Pavlov's dog experiment, I talked about a couple who had had a baby, and the baby was in NICU, but the mother went home. And this is a true story. I actually have a copy of the story saved in my notes. But the mother went home and she had to pump. So whenever she pumped, her husband would play games on the PlayStation. And her trigger became the loading music for the PlayStation. And after they brought the baby home, whenever her husband would play games on the PlayStation and the startup music would start, she would have letdown and she would start to leak everywhere, which just goes to show that you can create a conditioned reflex with any trigger. You just have to figure out what it's going to be for you, and then you have to consistently use it before every pumping session. If you're in your childbearing years, it's important to talk with your plastic surgeon openly to discuss possible future plans for lactation. Given the increased knowledge about the impact of breast reduction on lactation, your plastic surgeon should be interested in preserving your lactation ability, and he most definitely should be willing to discuss future lactation preoperatively. So, you know, plastic surgeons should provide full information to their patients for a complete and informed consent. If your doctor isn't willing to talk to you about that stuff, then my suggestion is that you find another doctor. So the next up is mastopexy or a breast lift. And a breast lift is much like a facelift for the breast. It's a very common surgery where sagging breasts are uplifted and made firmer. Breastfeeding is commonly thought to lead to sagging breasts, which it does to a degree. But we also learned in a previous episode that smoking is also a contributing factor to sagging breasts. Usually, a breast lift is done after childbearing years, and women undergo the procedure either alone or in conjunction with breast augmentation. And the operation usually involves removing excess skin and tissue, as well as elevating the nipple. There may be a slight loss of sensation to the nipple or the areola, but breast lifts theoretically should not affect your ability to lactate. And a breast lift is just a surgical method of lifting and repositioning the breast. What technique a surgeon will use will depend on the current position of your nipple and the desired results of, you know, how you want everything to end up looking. Because the lactation system remains intact after a breast lift, lactation is still possible. And while lactating after a breast lift is entirely possible, most women are able to. So, you know, there really shouldn't be an issue. However, some function may be lost due to the surgery itself, and there's always the possibility of severing a nerve or a duct, and you won't know for sure until you try. But a good indication of success is whether or not you have nipple sensation, and that goes with all the surgeries, because it's the act of suckling on the nipple that creates your brain to say, hey, we need to have a letdown. So as long as you're getting good sensation at the nipple, then you should be all right. So out of the three procedures in my textbook, breast augmentation is the most in-depth. I mean, it was 3 pages long. Breast reduction was about a page, and the breast lift was a few paragraphs. So there's a lot of information regarding breast augmentation and how it affects lactation. Breast augmentation is a common aesthetic surgical procedure in the United States. Most lactation consultants are likely at some point to have clients that have undergone this procedure. Now, there are several techniques that are used for breast augmentation. And there's several, you know, a couple of things that are really important to know. First is location. Different locations may be used as implant pockets, and each one has its own advantage. The subpectoral or beneath the pectoral muscle, this allows for the best mammography. The subfacial placement is deep in the breast tissue, but superficial to the muscle. So the subfacial pocket protects against capillary contracture. And I'm going to tell you what that is in a minute too. The subglandular pocket has long been regarded as the most natural pocket. The placement is deep in the breast tissue, but superficial to the pectoral fascia. The subglandular pocket has a high risk of capsular contracture. So what is capsular contracture? When an implant is placed, a fibrous scar tissue forms around the implant, creating a tissue capsule. The body forms a capsule like this around objects recognized by the body as foreign objects. And actually, that's pretty cool because it, you know, wraps it up in like this little cocoon trying to protect your body from it. The capsule is usually soft or slightly firm, but it's not noticeable. And that little cocoon also helps keep the implant in place. But sometimes a capsule forms that is unusually hard and dense. The capsule tightens and squeezes the implant. It can cause chronic pain and absolutely distort the shape of the breast. That's what capsular contracture is. And from what I've heard, it's really painful. Another disadvantage of subglandular is the mammography challenges. And, you know, it gets to be tough to take those pictures when the implant is in front of everything. Subglandular may be the best option for large-breasted women or women with low breasts that sit low. Now, there are currently 5 incision options. Axillary, which is done by making an incision underneath the arm and placing the implant below the gland or muscle. This approach has advantages of scar avoidance, interferes less with mammography, and wouldn't interfere with sentinel lymph node biopsies. periareolar, which is an incision made at the nipple areola complex. Even though surgeons like this incision because it provides good exposure of the pocket and ensures that the scar is less visible. However, these incisions are associated with decreased nipple sensation and decreased lactation. So inframammary is the most popular choice, and this incision is made under the breast, and the implant is placed under the breast tissue or muscle. The scar is visible unless placed in the inframammary crease. Then there's transabdominal. This one was really weird to me when I read it. No incision is made on the breast. An abdominoplasty incision is made, and the implants are inserted through two small tunnels on each side of the chest. This type of procedure is usually done in conjunction with a tummy tuck. This type of insertion is good for women who already have good breast shape, want smaller implants, are short-waisted, or have low breast position. It also leaves no scarring on the breast. And then the last one is periumbilical, and that's when the implants are placed through an incision at the navel rather than the chest. This type of insertion is used infrequently and is only used for saline implants that are placed subpectorally. So although augmentation supposedly has less impact on lactation than reduction, women who have undergone breast augmentation have historically had greater risk of lactation insufficiency compared to women that have not had surgery. And women that have had the periareolar or the transareolar incision have a greater incident of lactation insufficiency. In 1990, Neifert studied 139 women who were breastfeeding healthy full-term infants. The mothers with periareolar incisions were more than four times likely to have insufficient milk compared with those that did not have breast surgery. In a Hearst study from 1996, 42 women had augmentation surgery. 64% had insufficient lactation. Of the women who had periareolar incisions, none lactated sufficiently compared with the 50% who made sufficient milk with submaxillary or axillary incisions. Most women with implants are able to lactate. Now, to what degree, you know, it's hard to say. There's really not a lot of research on it. And whether you're able to, you know, lactate well will depend on the original state of your breast before surgery and the type of incision that was used. One seldom talked about thing is how lactation may affect your implants. It's normal for your breast to change in size and shape during the lactation process, and lactation won't affect your implants per se, but it may affect the overall size and shape of your breasts. And here's something that I didn't actually know was a concern until I came across a small article. But it stated that if you have saline implants, healthcare providers see no harmful effect if saline mixes with breast milk. Saline is absorbed by the body, so apparently it's not a big deal if your saline implants are leaking. I think I'd be a little worried if my saline implants were working. I couldn't find a lot of information on this. My previous statement about saline, you know, that's about all there was. There was a small study that indicated that silicone from breast milk isn't absorbed into an infant's GI tract. And the American Academy of Pediatrics released a paper stating that silicone implants should not serve as a deterrent to breastfeeding. So there's not really enough scientific research available that states whether breast implants may leak into your breast milk. I did find a couple of documented cases where traces of silicone were found in tested breast milk from women who had breast augmentation surgery. So that's definitely something to think about if you're considering having augmentation and you're in your childbearing years, if you're going to have children. You know, maybe talk to a doctor to find out if there's more information available as to whether your implants will secrete I don't necessarily mean leak, you know, but just maybe secrete residual silicone into your breast milk. That might be something that's important to know. Here's something I didn't know. And I've never had implants, and I've never actually thought about getting implants. But I thought all implants were, for lack of a better way to explain it, essentially bags filled with liquid. That's what I thought they were. They're just bags filled with liquid. Well, today I found out that there are silicone implants called gummy bears because of the way they feel. And they're high-strength silicone gel. Or I guess in the medical world, they call them cohesive gel implants. And they have a semi-solid form because the material is very dense. Now, regular silicone implants is liquid in a bag. But these, the gummy bears, they're still placed inside a bag. They have a hard outer shell, kind of like M&M's, I guess. They're soft in the middle and hard on the outside, like regular implants. I just thought that was cool. When I came across the name gummy bear implants, I was like, what the hell? You know, my first vision in my head was this giant gummy bear being placed in a breast pocket, but clearly that's not what it is. Anyway, so like with breast reduction, during augmentation, nerves, ducts, and glands can be damaged during surgery. And the type of incision made during surgery is important to know and discuss this beforehand with your surgeon, that it's really important for your lactating future. The area where your implants are placed may also affect your ability to lactate. Implants placed under the chest muscle can prevent damage to your milk ducts and nerves. Implants placed under the chest muscle also will not cause silicone to seep into your breast milk. The milk-making tissue or glandular tissue has a layer of muscle on top of it. If the implants are inserted between them, there can be excessive pressure on the glandular tissue, and this may affect milk supply. All right, ladies, so those are some of the highlights on breast surgery. When you're looking for help or advice for your lactation journey and you've had one of these procedures done, it's important to know the who's he, what's it of your procedure. Whether you talk to a lactation consultant or someone who has experienced their own lactation journey, knowing a few key details could save you days, weeks, or even months of frustration. So talk to your plastic surgeon if you're going to have it done, and make sure you know exactly what it is that he's doing. That's it for today. Don't forget to go by the website. Check out the blog. If there's anything that I can do to help you, you know, email me, hit me up. If you have any questions, have a great day. This is Michaela at Lactation Station.